Good morning and welcome to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Childs, and you're listening to WDRT 919 FM. For this episode, as well as many other great podcasts, you can go to WDRT.org for archival episodes. And today, alongside Crawford Stewardship Project's Program Coordinator, Forrest Yonke, I am sitting down with Professor Kelvin Rodolfo. Kelvin is a retired professor at University of Illinois at Chicago, where he taught earth and environmental sciences for 30 years. Kevin and his wife have been landowners in the Driftless area for decades, and today we are going to talk about the karst geology that makes that Driftless area so special. So Forrest, I know you and Kelvin have worked together quite a bit in the past. You are kind of our resident karst expert. If we do have one on staff, it's definitely you. And so if you wanted to talk a little bit about your experience with Kelvin, and then we'll get right into it.
Yeah, we're really, really excited to have you with us here today, Kelvin. I've really enjoyed being your apprentice over the last decade or so and really diving into the crevices and crannies of this landscape and what it means for different land uses in the area. Of course, Crawford Stewardship Project is very focused on conservation and clean water and clean air and how all this ties together on this landscape. And we know these are also your passions. We've really leaned on you a lot over the years. You've been our speaker for many of our annual karst explorations, and you helped us with our karst landscapes and groundwater susceptibility survey, some really interesting civic science projects that we did that maybe we can talk more about later. But first, maybe let's just start off with what brought you here and got you into geology and why is this your passion?
Good morning, Joseph. It is Joseph, isn't it?
Yes.
Joseph, and of course I know Forrest. It's very good to be here. What brought my wife Kathy and I to the Driftless was basically we wanted to retire to an area that will withstand climate change better than most. And whether you know it or not, and you're a resident of this area, you are in one of the best places to survive climate change. When we came here, we wanted to do permaculture farming on a small scale, and my main interest was looking for an area with a south-facing slope, because we wanted to build an earth-sheltered, solar-heated house. And I failed in due diligence because I should have looked around a little bit more. I found out, to our dismay, a year later, that we were located on land less than a mile from the Vernon County landfill, which is now taking up a good deal of my time because we have serious problems with it.
So when you talked about the Driftless area being one of the best places to survive climate change and being in an area that is maybe got a competitive advantage over some others, what about the Driftless area makes that such a good place to survive climate change?
Well, it turns out we are in a fairly good latitude. We are fairly far enough north, so we won't suffer too much from the increases in global temperature, but one of the main things is that if we are going to survive, we need water. The very first thing you need, or you need air first, of course, but second thing you need, you must have water, and we have good water here if we take care of it, and that's where karst comes in, because karst areas are exceedingly vulnerable to groundwater contamination.
Can you explain a little bit, within CSP we deal with the word karst a lot, but can you explain to maybe someone that's listening on the radio or tuning in online, what is karst? When we speak of that, because we're going to say it quite a bit throughout this episode, what is karst?
Well, karst is a German mispronunciation of the name of a plateau, the Karst Plateau, which straddles Eastern Italy and Western Slovenia. It's a karstic area, and the first people to study it were a couple of German geologists. And if you looked at the landscape, if you were on the Kras Plateau, you would be right at home. It looks just like the Driftless. Carbonate rocks, springs, caves, what have you. But Germans being Germans, I can say that because I'm half German myself, they like to butcher the language in a Germanic way. So Kras became Karst. And now everywhere in the world that you have that kind of geology, it's called Karst geology instead of Kras geology. But anyway,
that's... So what's the difference between Karst geology and, say, I mean, I'm a geologist, very novice, like I don't know much about it, so... What is the difference between karst and, say, another type of geology? Are there differences, and what do those differences mean for those who live in a karstic area?
Well, absolutely. Karst depends basically on having the right kind of rock. And the right kind of rock is a carbonate. Limestone, common limestone, is calcium carbonate. Dolomite, which is the rock that underlies this part of the Driftless, is calcium magnesium carbonate, or it's called dolomite. And the difference is that instead of pure calcium carbonate, it's calcium magnesium carbonate, which dissolves more slowly.
Okay.
And so if you're going to have karst, you need a carbonate rock, like limestone or dolomite. And that's the primary thing.
So you talked a little bit about caves and springs and all the water that we have here, and I would imagine a rock that dissolves more easily, being a karstic feature, and a bunch of water around here, and that eventually leads to these caves, and I would imagine that has some different meanings for our groundwater and surface water around here. You know, it's maybe some things you have to consider that you wouldn't have to consider if you were on a non-karstic geology.
You have to be concerned because if you have karst geology, it's characterized by both vertical fractures and horizontal layers that weather out faster than the containing layers. And so what you have are vertical fractures down which water can percolate. It can then percolate sideways along layers that dissolve more easily and encounter another vertical fracture and eventually make their way down to greater depths. One of the big problems is that in Wisconsin there are two kinds of karst. On the east side of the state, the karst rock is very close to the surface. It's called the Silurian limestone or Silurian dolomite. It dissolves a lot more easily than the dolomite that we have here. But very close to the surface, you have this rock that's full of voids and fractures that can hold water. So the karstic rock on the east side is itself an aquifer. It contains water. If it gets polluted, it'll be a problem. But it's not. Impossible that you can clean it out. It would just cost a lot of money, but you could clean it out. Over here, our karst is not what the water resides in. Instead, the rock, which is full of voids and fractures, allows water to percolate through it down into deeper layers. And those deeper layers include the sandstone layers from which the people of the western Wisconsin Driftless area get their groundwater. The water is contained in the small pores between grains of sand. So if you pollute a sandstone aquifer, it's polluted forever. There's no way you can clean it out.
So just to kind of boil this down for my own sake, on the eastern side, the karstic feature is what actually holds the water.
Yeah.
And on the western side, the karstic feature is what transports the water to, you know, more long-term, very permanent storage in a sandstone aquifer. It doesn't act as the aquifer itself.
Yeah. For example, the city of Viroqua gets its water from... the Mount Simon sandstone, which is about 1,000 feet below the surface. The good thing about that is it'll take a while for pollution to get to it. But once, if we allow pollution to get to it, it's going to be ruined as a groundwater source unless you clean it out. Right now, you can open your tap in Viroqua and get good water. But at some point, if it gets polluted, you're going to have to clean that water. And that would be a sad thing.
And what would you say the region that is considered to be this this karstic, this western side, where is it a large, you know, is it different from Viroqua to Soldiers Grove? Is it different from Viroqua to, you know, northwest Illinois? Are we all residing on that same feature, or is it fairly localized?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. On the west, let's step back here. All of our layers of rock are almost horizontal, but they tilt a little bit westward and a little bit southward. In Grant County, to our south, the rocks that we have here are not at the surface. Instead, younger rocks are at the surface. Those include the Galena and Platteville limestones. And then underneath, they have the same dolomite that we have at the surface here. But essentially, you can just think of it as we are having a smaller layer of rock up here, which has older rocks at the surface, a thicker layer of rock toward the south, with younger rocks sitting that are not present here. Does that make sense?
Yes. I'm kind of thinking of like a layer cake that's kind of on a slope or something. And so there's going to be stuff that is not here because it's we don't have that younger rock, but maybe it's further south and southwest we'd have that. Sorry, I don't mean to try and boil things down. It's just I can tell you're very, very knowledgeable on the subject, and I know I'm a lot closer to the average listener when it comes to karst than both you and Forrest. So just trying to, for the sake of the listener, boil these things down to where, you know, we can understand it. And this kind of leads me into my next question is, we talk about land use, we talk about the landfill that is here in Viroqua, and there's many others throughout the countryside in karst geology territory. But why does the fact that water transports very quickly down into the ground, which you would assume is a good thing, we talk about water infiltration, and that's a good thing that we're able to store water, but why does that have a different, you know, why are we concerned about that in karst geology versus somewhere else where it doesn't go down through the ground, through those cracks, fissures, and caves quite as quickly?
Right. Well, if you're farming and you use herbicides, your surface water will pick up herbicides, and so herbicides will go down with your water. If you are cattle farming on karstic terrain, then your manure will contribute to the surface water. Maybe I should back up a little bit. Why does water dissolve the rock in the first place? Well, everybody's heard of acid rain, but what people don't realize is regular rain. A regular raindrop will itself be slightly acidic, and that's because the raindrop is made of water, H2O, and it's traveling, it's falling through an atmosphere that contains a certain amount of carbon dioxide. So if you put water and carbon dioxide in contact anywhere, you're going to make what they call carbonic acid, which is a weak acid. But a lot, we make a lot of it because there's a lot of rain. So imagine a slightly acidic raindrop hitting the surface. it then it will join other surface waters, and they'll pick up a little more acid because of the decaying vegetation, is slightly acidic. And so the amount of carbonic acid in the water increases. That water now percolates down. And water always finds a way to move. Water is an almost magical substance. So it will go down through fractures, and it'll go along more soluble layers and find other fractures and go further down and so on. And so that's the problem. The other thing is, once a fracture has been slightly dissolved by that percolating water, it gets wider. So nothing succeeds like success. The more the water goes, the wider the conduits become, the faster the water can go. And it's like a runaway system. Mm-hmm. On a geological time scale, very slow, but inevitable.
So there's, I kind of think about, you know, you talked about water carrying, you know, flowing down through the ground, and obviously whatever is carried by that water is also hitching a ride with that, be it good or bad. You know, it's going to have whatever it's picking up through the rainfall, through the ground contact, through the surface water, that is going to be carried. And I like to, for my brain, just kind of think about it as like the ground as this big water filter, and, you know, a lot of the times the stuff that is in the water, if it moves slowly enough through those layers, it's being filtered, and that's why we have these aquifers full of, you know, fresh water, and it's not muddy, even though it might be muddy or dirty on top. And for karst geology, it's like you took a nail and drove it through that water filter and then pulled the nail out. Now you've got a hole that's in your water filter, so it's not actually getting filtered out. It's moving very quickly down into, you know, your little pitcher of water. So it's not filtering out as effectively as it would, say, in a much more slowly moving geological feature.
That's all good. That's a common sense way of putting it. How fast does water percolate through the ground? Well, the typical rate of groundwater flow, say through a sandstone layer, would be an inch to a few inches, no more than a foot per day. But in karst terrain, in fact, in the area where the Vernon County landfill sits, they have measured percolation rates through the rocks of like 187 feet per day, which is disastrous.
That sounds made up. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's scary. And in fact, those rates were discovered when they reevaluated that landfill site. Prior to that, the first engineers used antique techniques. And 10 years later, when they wanted to expand the landfill vertically, DNR wanted them to be studied again, and the new people used new techniques, and they came up with percolation rates one or two orders of magnitude than they previously thought, meaning tens to hundreds of times faster than was previously thought when the permit to build the landfill was issued.
That's, wow.
And that's this is a
world that, you know, I've never spent, you know, we always did like little geology stuff in school, and I found it interesting, but like this is seems to be very engaging and something that's I think I kind of want to look into a little bit more, and I hope people listening too will, you know, appreciate what where they live and why it is special and why we get to enjoy all these springs and caves and streams and all the abundant water that we have here, but also maybe take away a little bit of like, well, it's kind of a blessing and a curse. You got to take care of it when you have a gift that's this special. And we're going to get into maybe some ways that we can take care of the beautiful karst geology that we have here. But first, we're going to do a short station identification. This is WDRT 91.9 FM. You can find this episode of the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on WDRT.org, and also go back and have a listen to our other episodes. I am your host, Joseph Childs, and today, alongside CSP's program coordinator, Forrest Yonke, I'm sitting down with Professor Kelvin Rodolfo. Kelvin is a retired professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he taught earth and environmental sciences for 30 years. Calvin and his wife have been landowners in the Driftless area for decades, and today we've already been discussing what karst is and why it's so special and why there are some special considerations that need to be thought about. And we're going to continue talking a little bit more here about maybe land uses and some special things that people may have to think about here in the karstic area that we live in. And Forrest, if you want to kind of take us away here.
Yeah, before the break, we were starting to talk about the variability of this landscape and how quickly water can move through one kind of rock or another kind of rock, and even between karstic rocks. Kelvin, you were saying, like, the limestone is more soluble, the dolomite is less soluble, and so from that you might think, well, the limestone is therefore more susceptible and the dolomite would be less susceptible to contamination. However, I also know that the dolomite here is much older. So maybe you can speak a little bit to those nuances of, so yes, there is younger limestone at the top that is more soluble, and there's older dolomite underneath that is less soluble but has been there for longer and therefore has had more opportunity to dissolve and form these sorts of features.
That's all true. I have a hero, a karst geology hero. I'm a professional geologist, but not a professional karst geologist. I studied mainly most of my work, at least in the last couple of decades, has been on disaster mitigation, volcanoes and earthquakes, and faulting. But my hero is Michael Day, who's also a retired professor. He taught many years at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and he is perhaps the only expert or the only person in the world that can claim to be an expert on the driftless karst. Among other things, he did what you might consider boring work, where he put chunks of our dolomite in site where it could interact with the elements, and then every year he'd take out the samples and weigh them and see how fast they dissolved. He's the only person who's done that kind of work. He is the expert on karst and caves in the Midwest. And anyway, he is one of my heroes, and he's the person I turn to when I want to learn something about karstic geology. When you hear me talking, you're really hearing Mick Day talking.
Mm-hmm. So I guess off of that, and I appreciate that, and there is a lot of great information out there about karst geology in general, although I know Southwest Wisconsin has not been studied as much as we would like to see. And there is a lot of science out there that we do respect. I know there is some myths out there as well about karst geology, and particularly a notorious clay layer in the area, and that's been claimed that is protective of our groundwater. And I think that ties into this conversation here. We've talked about the sandstone and how water moves through that, through the karst layers, and now we have soil and subsoil, and sometimes we have clay in this area. So I'm wondering if you want to speak to that, especially, yeah, how protective is the clay subsoils in this area?
You're talking about a very sore spot in my...
I know.
Can I actually venture a little bit into state politics?
Well, I'm sure that with land use being a regulated thing, and most of the laws at the local level being related to land use, I'm sure that the state level politics, and even wider than that, may have an effect on karstic geology and land uses that happen upon it. So, by all means, go ahead.
Okay. So. when I say politics, I'm not talking Republican versus Democrat. I'm talking about how state resources are allocated. It is a fact that the east side of the state is the rich side of the state, and the west side of the state is the poor side of the state. And so there are two consequences for that. First of all, the tendency is for state funds to be expended more on the east than on the west. One of the consequences of that is that our geology on the west is not studied anywhere near as well as it is studied on the east. One of the consequences of that, then, is that government geologists are familiar with eastern karst and not with western karst. And at one point, a few months ago, a DNR hydrologist was quoted as saying that DNR still has no position on whether the Viroqua landfill site is on karst or not, and that's inexcusable. If you want to find out what the general situation of karst in the state of Wisconsin is, I can refer you to a five-page article by the Wisconsin Geologic and Natural History Survey called Karst, and let me read the title of it. It's easily understandable, and it encapsulates everything just on a single page. And it's called,
This is how you know you're listening to a real professor, shuffling through papers.
So, if you go on the internet and you ask for karst and sinkholes, you'll get this paper from the Wisconsin Geologic and Natural History. Says karst and sinkholes. First page: what is karst? And it shows a really nice diagram of karstic features. A page that says, how do sinkholes form? In a very simple way, it shows how they form. And then it shows a map of Wisconsin, and it shows what the karstic areas are, without getting too much into the detail of east versus west, but at least it's a start. And then it shows, it warns you about groundwater contamination. And so you can access that very easily. Just Google karst and sinkholes and get this paper from the WGNHS, and you will be adequately informed.
Yeah, they're really great partners. They do some great work. We, of course, would hope they can do some more work in this area, and in fact, we know that they are doing some studies. We hope that we will maybe have some updated karst bedrock layers information coming out this year. Also, I want to give a quick plug to our karstography page that Crawford Stewardship has created with you, Kelvin, and our friends at Legion GIS, with lots of different karst layers that people can check out. We did some sinkhole mapping that we have up on that for Crawford County. We'd love to keep doing more of this civic science. And I would like to also invite anyone and everyone who's interested in learning more about this to this year's Karst Exploration, which is going to be happening on July 19th at the Gays Mills Community Commerce Center at 1 p.m. That goes for a few hours. We have a great little presentation. We're hoping to have one of the Wisconsin Geological Survey folks there to present for us, maybe on some of this new information, and then go for a tour of karst features.
Yeah. Thanks, Forrest, for mentioning that. The karst field trip is a great event. I'm not a karst nerd or a geology nerd like some people out there that would love this event, but I absolutely love this. Last year, we got to go to a farm that I rented and see some really cool springs. Come on out. It's a great time. It's an educational event. Bring your kids, bring your parents, bring whoever you want, but it's a great time. That'll be July 19th. And with that, we're going to wrap up the radio portion. You can follow along online at wdrt.org. This has been the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Childs, and today I sat down along with Forrest Yonke and Professor Kelvin Rodolfo and talked a bit about karst. If you want to follow along, go to WDRT.org and find the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on the podcast page. Thank you.
So, yeah, we were talking about our karst exploration that Crawford Stewardship Project has annually, and Kelvin, you've really left your mark on that. Our format is the same as it's been for, oh, a decade and a half now of these events, where we have the first hour of the half billion years of local hydrogeological history, and then we take a tour of local sites in the area. Last year's was particularly focused on springs. Our new state geologist, Sue Swanson, is an expert on springs, and she came out and talked to us about that. And springs are a really great karst feature because they are the intersection of groundwater and surface water, where the groundwater becomes surface water. And that's, you know, we've talked, I think, a lot about the challenges that and the dangers that karst geology presents. It also gives us springs. It also gives us these features, which are also a blessing in many ways. So, yeah, I'm wondering if you want to talk about springs in particular and, how that water interacts and how it becomes surface water and groundwater and vice versa.
That's a very good topic to talk about because, among other things, it has major financial implications. Mm-hmm. When water percolates underground and stays underground, it gets anywhere below 16 feet. The temperature doesn't change. All the year round, it's going to be well above freezing. Eventually, when it comes out of the ground as a spring, it's cold water. So these are cold water springs. And the reason why we have such great trout fishing here is because the trouts love the cold water streams. And so it's really important not only for our own drinking water, but for our trout fishing industry. The Driftless brings in trout fishermen from all over, which we're famous for our cold water springs and cold water trout. And I understand that at least $1 billion comes into this area, brought in by trout fishermen with their needs for housing and food and groceries and what have you. And so it's an important thing to protect.
Mm-hmm. So not just talking about, you know, the financial aspect of it, but in my mind, when you picture, you know, a Driftless home or a Driftless homestead, the first thing that comes to my mind is like a babbling spring that's right outside the back door. You can go out and grab a glass of water and drink it right then and there, and it's the best tasting water. It's not going to hurt you. But because that's coming from, like we talked about earlier, that conduit that's directly from the surface to the groundwater, that, you know, that hole in the water filter, if you will, it can be completely clear, and it can also be impaired and be completely clear and coming right out of the ground. And you wouldn't think that, you know, this spring that has been around for however long it's been around, that it could possibly be a source of pollution or contaminant that could be harmful to you and your family.
Yeah.
And not to mention the fish and the people that come and stay in Airbnbs and, you know, get supper at the supper club and spend lots of money and rent cars and all sorts of different things in the area that help quite a few people, you know, survive in the tourism industry. So it just, to me, springs really encapsulate everything that is to love about the Driftless. It's the hills and the woods and the pastures and the fish and the water. It's like everything boiled into one.
And yet, to your point, we still have to be careful because it can taste good, it can smell good, it can look good, and it can still be chock full of E. coli, yes, and nutrients or cryptosporidium or salmonella or a host of other things that we can't perceive with our senses. So that's something I also picked up from you, Kelvin. You know, we all love springs. it's become this sort of idealized thing that we should, you know, if in a perfect world, we'd all just drink straight out of the springs. And yet, maybe, you know, a day or two after a major rain event, I would probably not drink from just about any spring.
No, I mean, we, a few years back, I guess around 2010, we had local springs analyzed. Mm-hmm. And Croom Spring, which is one of the prettiest springs in the state, mm-hmm. just off Seas Branch Road near County Y, here in Viroqua Township, after heavy rain, the analysis was over 1,000 colony-forming units of E. coli, mm. and 2 weeks later, it was still down to about maybe 500 CFUs, they call them, colony-forming units, and that's just not a good
thing. And for some reference, what is the, you know, allowable or the safe level of colony-forming units of E. coli that you would measure in a stream that you would say, or a spring that you would say is safe to consume?
I can't answer that because I don't have those data.
For reference, and, you know, if you're drinking your own tap water, there is really no standard. A public swimming beach will have a warning posted at 750 colony-forming units and will be closed at 1,000 colony-forming units of E. coli.
And so that's not drinking, that's just...
Right, that's
contact.
Basically the level that you don't want to be swimming in just in case you get a little in your mouth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that, yeah, that just puts that into perspective. So what can I ask, what would be the cause of, like, the big rainfall? It's obviously the E. coli, at least maybe it's obvious to me, but it's not in the rain itself. So where, how is this getting into springs? I could see how it's getting into surface waters that... Mm-hmm. You know, some runoff from fields, but how would it be getting into springs that are, as you can see them bubbling up out of the ground, you think there wouldn't be any, you know, E. coli in there?
Well, if cattle are grazing on the land well above the spring, then cattle manure will give you E. coli, and we have a lot of cows. I don't mean to bash. Dairy farmers, because they have a hard time as it is. But it is a fact that if you are in karst terrain, cows will contribute E. coli to your groundwater.
So would there be a difference in, say, manure from a cow that is walking in a, you know, a 8 to 12 inch tall grass and, you know, depositing manure straight out the rear end onto the ground versus, you know, having a manure pit where it's mixed with water and then applying that to, you know, agricultural fields? Is there a difference in how readily that can be, that manure or that contaminant can be percolated down into groundwater or ran off into surface water?
Well, I don't have data, and I'm not an expert on that, but obviously if you are ponding manure and the ponded manure can make its way into the ground. It will contain more. I'm all for what do they call the grazing?
Rotational grazing.
But even they will deposit.
So it's just a good practice to not drink from the stream that you're grazing the cows in. Maybe get upriver of that.
Well, better than that, if you have a spring and you want to drink out of it, you have the water checked. That's the first thing you want to do. You may want to do it several times after a heavy spring. Rain would be a good time to test. But empirically, if you're going to drink water, you want to know what's in that water. You want to test that water.
That just makes perfect sense. And maybe not to go down too far on the spring route, but I think this ties to some land use practices. The term fisher spring, what is a fisher spring versus, I don't know, what, like a year-round spring, you know, something that, you know, it rains hard and then for the next week I've got water, but then if I don't get rain, there's no water coming out of that. Is there a difference in the water quality that would be coming out of those, or should you be more leery of a spring that is intermittent?
Yeah, I'll jump in on that. I guess in general, where there's big changes happening, I think that is a yellow flag, if not a red flag. So if you see, you know, if it's disappearing and reappearing, then that means that there is large amounts of water flushing through areas that maybe didn't have large amounts of water through it, and so maybe accumulated things. You know, we've been talking about everything poops. You know, our surfaces accumulate feces, and those include pathogens in them, and then when those get washed, that carries that through to the water. And like we've been talking, it's not just sandstone where it's going to percolate through slowly here. We have those karst direct conduits where it can flow quickly, and therefore those contaminants can get through very quickly. So most of our streams and rivers are fed by base flow, and by that I mean groundwater slowly actually pushing up from the ground and into it, and that water has moved hopefully relatively slowly through the landscape. Whereas, yeah, in these intermittent streams, and we have all these dry washes and disappearing streams around here that are changing very quickly, those are karstic, and they're going to be changing quickly. And if it's changing quickly and flushing through quickly, then it could be carrying a fair amount of things that you may or may not want to be drinking in it. Am I doing all right on general concepts here?
Yeah, sure. By the way, let's be fair to E. coli. It's got a bad name, but and it is bad, but it's not the only bad one.
Right.
They analyze for E. coli because it's the standard for bacterial contamination, but there are many other bad ones that go along with it. So don't zero in and say, well, if this bacterium is not E. coli, it's okay. E. coli is the standard measure.
So I think of it much like, you know, the dose makes the poison, that old adage of a little bit. We live in a world where we're exposed to a little bit of contaminants just by breathing air and being in the same room as other people and touching surfaces. But, you know, if you drink too much water, you can still die. You know, it's the dose that makes the poison. So there's always going to be a presence of bacteria in pretty much any sample of water or anything that you know, your food has bacteria.
Surface water.
Yes.
Anyway, groundwater hopefully shouldn't. But, you know, even the best spring, and I've been drinking out of a spring my entire life since I was old enough to toddle down to the spring, and there is E. coli in that. We have tested it, but to your point, it's single-digit colony-forming units of E. coli, and to your point, Kelvin, E. coli is just our indicator. It means that there's some bacteria coming from the intestines of warm-blooded animals going out onto the landscape, and if there's so that means that it could include a whole bunch of other things. I'd much rather drink E. coli water than I would salmonella water or staph water or a whole host of other nasty things. But it's basically the big bad pathogen we point out because that's what people test for.
It's the celebrity bacteria.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about land use practices, and we got down the stream rabbit hole, which is awesome too. I love talking about water. I'm an avid fisherman, so it's always something. I'm around water all the time, and just learning about it is interesting to me. So with land use practices, are there other things besides like a catastrophic failure of, you know, like a really bad leaky gas, a fuel tank, or a flood that blows out a manure lagoon and has like the things that don't make the headlines in the newspapers that gets everyone up in arms? Are there other land use practices that could affect quality or quantity of water? Maybe that the one I think of is like erosion. I know that's going to have an impact on surface water, but what kind of impact would that have on groundwater?
I guess I don't quite follow your question.
Sorry, I do this quite a bit. I'll ask like three questions in one. So are there other land use practices that, you know, that aren't in the news, or events that aren't newsworthy? Like I said, the the catastrophic failure of a manure lagoon. Are there other things that can affect groundwater quality that we wouldn't think to think about on a daily basis?
Well, there's one thing that people in the Driftless need to understand. Impounding water or impounding waste or impounding anything on karst terrain is not a good idea.
And when you say impounding, you mean holding.
The holding, building a dam. If, for example, in our area, the Seed Branch Dam, just off County Y, it ruptured after bad rains in 2007 and in 2008. The dam itself was good, but the ends of the dam abutted on karstic terrain. And if you impound water, then the water rises and the water pressure increases. And what happened at the Seas Branch Dam several times is that, after repair, by the way, is that the pressures are so great that the water finds fractures and cavities to run through, and it ruins the end of the dam and ruptures the dam at the end. I think at one point, Dennis Brault, who lives very close to the Seas Branch Dam, said that a rock about the size of a Volkswagen just blew out like nothing, and that image has remained in my head for a long time. But no, do not build any kind of an impoundment, and that includes, by the way, landfills. It's bad to build anything on karst terrain because, no matter how well you build it, if it fails underground, then whatever filter or whatever containment layer you build is going to fail too. And in geologic time, any compoundment is destined to fail. It's just a matter of time.
So when you talk about impoundments, are you speaking of larger scale ones, or are you talking like smaller? Because in the regenerative agriculture sphere that I live my life in, that is a huge thing that is talked about is water infiltration. And generally, they're not permanent impoundments, but they are slowing the water, getting it to go down into the ground so that it isn't running off and taking soil and contaminants with it. But the like swales and small like leaky dams they're meant to just catch water from large rainfall events, and then they don't have a clay liner. They slowly infiltrate that water. Are those different from what you're talking about, as in, you know, larger scale impoundments where they're sealed, they're meant to be there permanently?
No, I'm a great fan of swales. Our property is swaled, these are small ditches, no deeper than 18 inches, that follow the topography and collect water and allow the water to infiltrate rather than run off. And those are good things. But even a fairly small impoundment, like in our development, not on our property directly, but on our neighbor's properties, someone a long time ago built a small dam, maybe 4 feet high, and it failed eventually because we sit on the dolomite, and every several years we get a new sinkhole. We expect it. That's what happens. Mm-hmm. So, but even a fairly small impoundment may cause problems. I would say if you're going to impound at all, the smaller the better.
Yeah, this reminds me of one of the karst explorations we did in Seneca, and we went and checked out one of these high up on the watershed little retention dams, not meant to really hold water, even just to slow the water when it's starting to run off the landscape. And right uphill of where they put that little check dam, there was a line of brand new sinkholes popping up from there, because, you know, we assume that there was less water infiltrating in at that point. When they put the check dam there, it slows the water, more water starts infiltrating there, and therefore probably flushed out some underground cavity that then collapsed into a sinkhole and then is now becoming a line of sinkholes. So yes, it's different, and there are degrees of risk, certainly, but even good practices, just slowing the water slightly on karstic terrain comes with extra challenges and come along with sinkholes.
There's an environmental slogan, which I will repeat here, which is really important. And it says, you cannot do just one thing. Mm-hmm. You cannot do just one thing. You have a purpose. You do something. There will be consequences. And sometimes they call those things side effects. But they're not side effects. They're effects that you didn't anticipate. Or they're effects that you don't like. But they're effects anyway. Like if you want to, clean smelling armpits and you build an aerosol, you use chlorofluorocarbons for the propellant. Well, you're not thinking about the upper atmosphere where that those chemicals, which are very stable in our environment, they migrate very slowly up, and then all of a sudden you've got eventually you'll wind up with an ozone hole. And so, you cannot do just one thing. And it's in karst terrain, you have to constantly remember, you cannot do just one thing. You have to think it through.
I'm going to write that quote down. That's a great quote to sit and think about not just with karst geology and, when we're talking about environmental or conservation practices, but just everything, you might be advocating for this certain thing because you really like it, but it may be taking away from somebody else's ability to do something that they want to do. So mm-hmm. That's a very, very good quote, and I will write that down and save it. So we talked. Go ahead.
If you do, please credit the source, because it came out of a guy named Garrett Hardin, who was a premier environmentalist, as far as I'm concerned. Garrett Hardin is who came up with that. And the first time I heard him say that, I realized how important it was. And a lot of other people did, too. So it became an environmental slogan.
Okay. Garrett Hardin. That wouldn't be Miss Hardin's son. That's the only Hardin I know. So we're talking a little bit about land uses, and I think that slogan takes us right into right into land uses and how you could be spreading fertilizer on, because that's your soil sample said that you need to put on some phosphorus or another source of fertilizer, and your intent is to give the soil what it needs so that the corn or the soy or your hay or whatever it is can grow and you can harvest it. And you can feed it to your cattle or sell it and feed your family. That's your intent. But like you said, you can't do one thing. You could be maybe over-applying or applying at the wrong time of year, or you didn't check the forecast and it's going to rain the next day. Mm-hmm. And eventually that could end up harming somebody's water that is downhill from you or miles away that you wouldn't mm-hmm. have thought about. So these practices that are all too often trying to blanket regulate throughout the entire state. They don't really make sense in an area that is especially susceptible to that second or third thing that you didn't plan on doing affecting somebody negatively. And you talked earlier, right before we switched over from the radio show to the podcast, about money that is spent on the eastern half of the state versus the western half, and how you can get a little bit of an idea on why, there's maps that are from the 1870s that are being used, still being referenced, that aren't, updated, or there's nothing newer for us to look at. Mm-hmm. So could you dive in a little bit on kind of that political regulation mm-hmm. stuff that affects the land uses that, as we've established, affect the individual lives of people?
Right. Well, now is the time to talk about the round tree formation. I hate to say this, but it's almost like there was a conspiracy that arose on the east side of the state that the driftless area, the groundwater, is protected by a layer of clay, impermeable clay. And so you can build as many capos as you want on the driftless because the groundwater is protected by the round tree formation.
And I just want to give a little context using the word CAFO. It's a confined animal feeding operation. So think of a large feedlot or big dairy, basically anywhere that's going to have a bunch, like tons and tons of manure stored and applied to the ground. So I just wanted to give a little background there.
Right. So the Wisconsin Geological Survey only stopped. They wanted to. I think they had a program where they wanted to verify the existence of the Round Tree Formation, and they spent years looking for it, and they finally gave up. But 12 years ago, I wrote a diatribe about how wrong that the thinking is. It is not a formation in any sense of the term of the word, as geologists use them. It also happens to be it's a red clay, and you find it thickest in sinkholes. Why? Because the clay washes into the sinkhole, but it doesn't seem to be there enough to stop water from percolating through the sinkhole. Anywhere you find a red clay, it was casually called a round tree formation, and it just does not exist, and it does not protect the driftless area from CAFOs. It just does not.
So there is no magical force field that we have here in the driftless. Is that what you're saying? The round tree force field.
Mm-hmm. While we're at myths, my second favorite myth is the Lake Superior water that you're supposed to get out of your wells around here, meaning it's really good water because it comes from Lake Superior, it makes its way all the way down here. In point of fact, most of your groundwater is water that landed on the surface no more than 5 miles from where you are. And there was actually a brewery in La Crosse that advertised their use of Lake Superior water to make their beer.
Oh, really?
That water just does not exist. And groundwater doesn't travel from Lake Superior to provide the driftless people with good groundwater. It's just not true.
I think that's a very good point, that most of the water we're drinking is coming to us from a mile, 2 miles, maybe a few miles away from where we are.
So you need to be thinking about your neighbors.
Yep.
Whatever you do, think about your neighbors.
I love that point because it takes the idea of water, which for us in the United States is you go in, hot's on the left, cold's on the right, you turn it on, it's there, and it's safe, and you drink it for most of us in the United States. But it takes that from this magical thing that is just always there to realizing not only do I get all my, or because I get my water from 5 miles within my house or a couple miles within my house, now I should really be thinking about what are the land use practices that are happening within 5 miles of my house. And do I agree with those? Would I want my water to come from, you know, the practices that are being that are on the land within 5 miles of my house? And I, again, all this stuff is connected, but that brings us to a lot of, you know, local regulation and stuff like that that is talked about at length here on CSP. We've done a couple different interviews with people talking about it. So it really, there's no separating out one piece. And I think the thing that ties us all together, because it is such a necessity to our everyday life, is water and the quality of it. And, land use is something that directly affects the quality and quantity of our water, especially after talking with you, especially in karstic geology. It's just something that we have to think about more than someone who doesn't live in an area where, you know, you can spill a Mountain Dew in a sinkhole and you can drink it at the bottom of the hill. Like it's something that we have to think about a little bit more. Therefore, our regulations should reflect that a little bit more because it is such a huge part of our lives.
Well, we have to. I attended a community meeting last week there's a commission that's planning for the future of Viroqua. And they've done a lot of work, and they had a meeting of concerned citizens at the Commons here, and there was no mention of where the water is going to come from, so I couldn't help myself when the comments came up. I said there are three things we must have: we need clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and a responsible way of getting rid of our waste. If you're going to plan for, that's the thing you have to be thinking about when you're talking about expanding a city. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems maybe we get, you know, almost too caught up in the economic development when we talk about the future of our communities, and we do take it for granted that, oh, we'll just, you know, our main goal is to make sure more people start moving here and the money, you know, businesses are successful. And we might push that whole idea of clean air, water, and food and shelter, push that in the back because, oh, it's always been here. It's always going to be here.
Especially the waste, because that's stinky, so we don't want to talk
about that.
Yeah,
that's never here. everything else has been here, and our waste has never been here because we don't see it. So, you know, that doesn't come to the top of our mind. And I'm 100% guilty of that. When I think about my personal future, I don't think about where my water's coming from. I'm thinking about trying to find land that isn't $10,000 an acre so I can buy some. But you put a lot of stuff into perspective here today, Calvin. And again, I don't really have a deep passion for geology, but just talk, I do have a very deep passion for this area. I grew up here. We, you know, Forrest and I both grew up here. And so that special piece of this area of that karst geology and why we have the springs that we do and why we have, you know, world-renowned trout fishing and just the kind of the overall vibe of our area is more kind of tied to nature. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting learning about karst geology and how that does affect everyone's lives here, whether they are thinking about it or not. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that you came in today and had this really engaging conversation. I appreciate all the work that you've done with Crawford Stewardship Project in the past and hopefully in the future. And again, Forrest has talked about you at length, and I just met you today, but it felt like I've met you before because Forrest has mentioned your name quite a bit, and he holds you in very high regard. So I appreciate you coming in. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
So this has been Crawford Stewardship Podcast here on WDRT.org. Today we sat down with Calvin Rodolfo. Calvin's a retired professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, where he taught earth and environmental sciences for 30 years. Calvin and his wife have been landowners in the Driftless area for decades, and you can tell he's got a passion for geology and the area, and it really shows in this interview, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.